That's very generous of Cliff. He knows me so well, he could have said a lot of worse things. And I'm grateful, Cliff, grateful for your friendship, and very grateful to be here with you at Louisville. I thank you for coming to hear these words on a beautiful afternoon after lunch. I'm grateful you take the time, and I hope that you will be inspired and that you'll find some new thoughts that will help you in your ministry. It's really, I think, fortuitous that the Doors to Dialogue has now flowed together with the Festival of Theology and pursuing common themes with crossing borders. When I know Mary McClure Taylor and Cliff both have given their lives to mission, I used to say that that Christian mission is the crossing of borders in word and deed with the love of God seen in Jesus Christ. So whenever you talk about crossing borders, you're reminded of the term of mission, which has a lot of freight, both positive and negative to it, but essentially involves the matter of what happens when incarnational expressions of the gospel cross various borders and boundaries. Christian witness and ministry, mission and evangelism today, therefore, are taking place within the radically changing landscapes of world Christianity. And these changing landscapes, in my view, should change the paradigms, theological perspectives, partners, and the sharing of power as we all seek to join in God's ongoing mission in the world. And this includes congregations and ministries like your own. So the framework I'm going to share with you in this lecture identifies six specific ways in which the landscape of world Christianity is changing and then suggests some possible responses. My hope and prayer is that this will be helpful as we reflect on how these challenges are not just global ones, but also impact how we approach congregational ministry in North America. These six changes are geographical, spiritual, theological, economic, migratory, and ecumenical. That's what we're going to be talking about. First, geographical. When we talk about the changing geographical landscape of world Christianity, what almost immediately comes to mind is how the relocation of the majority of Christians are now found in the global south. The breadth and speed of these changes is without historic precedent. All this has been well studied and documented. We've heard some of that at lunch. We can review just a few facts that bring this into focus. For 1,000 years, the statistical center of Christianity, the point on the globe where an equal number of Christians were to the north, south, east, and west, for 1,000 years, that center of gravity was in Europe. From 1910 to 2010, it moved from Spain to a point near Timbuktu, Africa, which is the most rapid geographical shift in all of Christian history. So that by the year 1980, which for any of you who are 35 or older, which I think is all of you, almost, by 1980, for the first time in 1,000 years, more Christians were living in the global south than the global north. In 1910, only 2% of the African continent was Christian. A century later, 1 out of 4 Christians in the world was African. The Pew Research Center in April 4th in a new report said that by 2030, 40% of all Christians will be in sub-Saharan Africa. The continents of Latin America and Africa today hold 1 billion Christians, with trends that continue to grow. That movement has also gone to the east, to Asia. 350 million Christians there will grow by 2025 in just 10 years to 460 million. Interestingly enough, in the last decade, Islam in that continent grew by 1.7%. Christianity actually grew by 2.5%. In 1910, 80% of the world's Christians were found in Europe and North America. A century later, that had dropped to 40%. If you look at evangelicals, you see it even more dramatically. 90% were found in the U.S. and Europe in 1910. Today, 75% of all who self-identify as evangelicals are in the global south. And yesterday, on Sunday, it's estimated that more Christians worshiped in congregations in China than here in the United States. These trends are relatively clear. As Christianity continues to grow in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, by the end of this century, Christians living in the global south and east will number 2.8 billion, about three times more than Christians projected to be found in the global north. In many ways, we are witnessing a return of Christianity to the non-Western cultures of Africa and Asia, reflecting more the environments which first gave rise to the church. But now, Christianity is embedded in hundreds of cultures and languages, demonstrating an incredible diversity of peoples and places that have received its incarnational presence. What does this mean? Well, we can no longer think of Christianity as having a particular geographical or cultural center, which for centuries has been seen as rooted in the West. Of course, for parts of the Christian tradition, such as the Orthodox, this was never true. But now, universally, it is no longer true. This includes, I would argue, the Catholic Church, accounting for about one half of all the world's Christians. While Rome may remain its administrative and affectional center, the spiritual vitality and prophetic resonance so admired in Pope Francis has resulted because, for the first time in more than 1,200 years, he is a pope from the global south. He echoes the voice of two-thirds of all Catholics today who are found in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So when academics use the term world Christianity, they refer to this new reality of multifaceted, highly diverse presence of Christianity throughout the globe. This means, as never before, that mission today is polycentric and multidirectional. It flows from a multitude of places to a myriad of destinations and returns. And so think about this. If there is no center, then how can we speak in the same way of margins? Perhaps one of the implications of the dramatic geographical shift in world Christianity's landscape is that the Spirit is now radically transforming those assumptions. If mission now arises from any number of unexpected places and moves towards unanticipated destinations, then even reversing the definitions of who is at the center and who is at the margin doesn't really fully capture the new realities that we are encountering. But this much is clear. The animating forces, ministries, and movements which will shape the future of world Christianity are emerging largely from the global south. Christians in Africa, Asia, and Latin America will now be the primary authors of its vision and direction. My worry is that established churches in the United States may be the last to understand and internalize this new reality. Following the mindset of our nation, as I said at lunch, with its unmatched global economic and military power, our default assumption is that Christian witness and mission finds its center with us and flows out to the world. But all that has changed. If we don't recognize this, we will be blinded to the movement of God's Spirit in the world today. Second, the spiritual landscape. Changes in the landscape of world Christianity have to do with far more than just geography. And frankly, there's been a lot of stuff that's charted the geographical shift. What's needed now is that we reflect much more on the other dimensions of that shift and what it really means. Christianity has now emerged as a non-Western religion in its dominant expressions. Those are growing outside the familiar home of Western culture. We're witnessing today what people like Laman Sana and Andrew Walls call the spiritual resurgence of non-Western Christianity. With this come forms of Christian worship and practice focused far more on experience and on all the senses rather than those forms which have tended to be more rationalistic. And that trend cuts across denominational traditions. The most dramatic evidence of this is the rapid and even astonishing rise of Pentecostalism. We mentioned at lunch that Pentecostal revival was started in Los Angeles a little more than a century ago at Azusa Street. Now we see the explosive growth of Pentecostalism around the world in the last century. And that, along with the religious transformation of the African continent, are the two most compelling narratives of Christian history in the 20th century. And both of them continue today. Any of you who are 45 or older would be alive at the time when 5% of Christians identified themselves as Pentecostal, namely in 1970, within many of our lifetimes. Today, 1 out of 4 Christians in the world is Pentecostal or charismatic. Charismatic simply refers to those who exhibit Pentecostal gifts and practices but belong to non-Pentecostal denominations. 80% of Christian conversions in Asia are to forms of Pentecostal Christianity. 25% of all Pentecostals are actually found now in that continent. Researchers estimate that as many as 800,000 Chinese charismatic congregations can be found throughout Asia. Africa is home to almost 1 out of 3 of the world's Pentecostals. And in Latin America, Pentecostalism is growing at 3 times the rate of Catholicism. Globally, the growth of Pentecostalism is at about 4 times the rate of Christianity's overgrowth, ongoing growth. Or I like to think of it this way, 1 out of every 12 people alive in the world today is Pentecostal. For a movement regarded as only about a century old, this is an absolutely astonishing religious development. While Northern liberal and evangelical Christians often fail to recognize is that Pentecostalism has arisen in the global South, often without the history and baggage of colonialism. Churches in the Pentecostal tradition and style, with their emphasis on immediate spiritual experiences, detached Christianity from its white missionary control and empowered indigenous expressions of Christian faith in many parts of the world. The Atlas of Global Christianity, which is the most comprehensive resource dealing with the changes in world Christianity over the last century, puts it this way, quote, Pentecostalism became the main contributor to the reshaping of Christianity from predominantly Western to a predominantly non-Western phenomenon in the 20th century. Now, of course, Pentecostal is an elastic term, and you could find many examples that quickly spring to your mind which would say something opposite, and they're true. It's also the case that newer forms of spiritually expressive Christianity have also taken root in the soil of world Christianity, such as the African instituted churches, begun in Africa by Africans rather than as part of the Western missionary enterprise, and highly contextualized within non-Western cultures. So the overall picture is of a spiritual landscape of world Christianity that is rapidly changing by all of these new movements. Now, many in the ecumenical community view these trends with alarm. They worry that growing forms of Pentecostal expressions of faith around the world forsake the biblical call to social justice for all and to protect the gift of God's creation in favor of an individualistic piety that retreats from the world. Surely this is an honest and probing concern rooted in a clear ecumenical understanding of witness and mission. Yet, the ecumenical principles of dialogue and mutual understanding need to be applied here. We should all listen and learn carefully from the actual lived experience of Pentecostal communities and their testimonies. Further, we should give attention to researchers who have studied these communities. Scholars like Donald E. Miller and Tetsamo Yamamori in Global Pentecostalism, The New Face of Christian Social Engagement. And they don't have skin in this game. Neither of them are Episcopalians. They're scholars at the University of Southern California. They point to the widespread participation of those in the margins of society in Pentecostal communities and the resulting sense of social empowerment. When I attended the Pentecostal World Conference in Kuala Lumpur in late 2013 as an ecumenical guest, I was impressed by the presentation of Ivan Satyajata, who heads an Assemblies of God ministry in Kolkata, India, titled Power to the Poor, the Pentecostal Tradition of Social Engagement. He argued persuasively how empowerment of the marginalized in society has been a key factor of Pentecostal ministry in many parts of the world and a reason for its growth. Of course, just like other forms of Christianity, Pentecostalism includes widely diverse voices and examples of social witness or the lack of it. But it is the case, as we heard from Miguel at lunch, that while liberation theology rightly proclaimed the option for the poor themselves have opted largely for Pentecostalism. It's crucial for the broader church community to ask why this is so. Observers in the changing landscape of world Christianity will conclude that Pentecostalism has empowered the most effective missionary movement in terms of growth of Christianity in the last half of the century. And here's something to reflect on. Pentecostal communities now number around 600 million people, which now totals more than the 500 million believers that constitute the membership of all the World Council of Churches member denominations. That reflects partly the ecumenical challenge we now face. Third, the theological landscape. As world Christianity relocates itself geographically and displays new forms of spirituality, its foundational theological framework is also shifting. Andrew Walls, one of the pioneers in tracing the pilgrimage of world Christianity, he alternates between Edinburgh and Ghana at the Africa Christola Center in Ghana, one of the amazing new centers of research in these areas within the continent of Africa. Walls expresses it this way. The most striking feature of Christianity at the beginning of the third millennium is that it is a predominantly non-Western religion. We have long been used to a Christian theology that was shaped by the interaction of Christian faith with Greek philosophy and Roman law. These forms have become so familiar and established that we have come to think of them as the normal and characteristic forms of Christianity. In the coming century, we can expect an accelerated process of new development arising from the Christian interaction with the ancient cultures of Africa and Asia, an interaction now in progress, but with much further to go. We can think about the changing theological landscape in this way, and these are broad generalizations that are dangerous in any academic community. But as Christianity moved from as Christianity has now become a predominantly non-Western religion, it's moved out of the framework of Western culture and Enlightenment, which served as its theological home for 400 years. So as world Christianity makes that tradition, I think we can identify as broad generalizations three key movements, and I'm just going to throw them out for you. The individual and community, first of all. Enlightenment thought placed the primacy of the individual in understanding the political, social, and economic order. I mean, that's what the Enlightenment did, and those are values which none of us would want to give up. However, non-Western cultures often begin with the primacy of the community, stressing the values of belonging and mutual relationships. You see this in African culture, in Asian culture very strongly. Second, rational and supernatural approaches to knowledge. Western Enlightenment culture placed a priority on the mind's ability to know truth through rational thought and inquiry. Non-Western cultures often assume supernatural forces, both good and evil, are the means that unlock truth and reality. Now, I'm not saying which of these is right and wrong. I'm simply describing what is. Third, the material and the spiritual world. Enlightenment thought reinforced a clear boundary between the material and the spiritual, usually circumscribing the latter, the spiritual, to more narrow, personalized domains. Cultures in the non-Western world, and this is beneath Christianity, cultures in the non-Western world typically assume a far more fluid and interconnected relationship between the material and the spiritual, regarding them as mutually interdependent. Of course, these are simplistic summaries, and further, for some strains of the Christian tradition, thinking here again of the Orthodox, this doesn't describe their historical or theological journey. But the point is this. For most of world Christianity, the movement out of the enduring, comfortable cradle of Western culture to the non-Western world entails a fundamental reorientation of how culture and faith interact in the process of theology. And that's always what's going on, how culture and faith relate in the process of theology and around crucial experiences involving how we understand truth and say what is real. There's an African theologian and author, Akintunde Akinade. He's from Nigeria. He's teaching now at Georgetown, who describes the developments of non-Western Christianity in this way. Christianity has blossomed in societies outside the Western Hemisphere and has become more powerful and nuanced in the process. The anti-structural character of the non-Western phase of world Christianity plays itself out in characteristics such as charismatic renewal, grassroots revival, massive exorcism, vibrant house churches, robust indigenization efforts, and effective lay leadership. Churches from the third world are vigorously defining Christianity on their own terms. The new day that dawns will permanently alter the place and nature of Christianity in the 21st century. So therefore, a changing theological landscape that we've only briefly described here presents a fresh framework and a new set of questions for how we think about and how we practice Christian ministry and mission. I think it lays out a whole new theological agenda before us. Next, the economic landscape. My purpose here is to address the growing imbalance of economic resources as well as the resources of social organization and theological capital that divide world Christianity, primarily between the churches of the global north and those of the global south. Now, of course, this reflects the overall realities of the globalized economy, which I think we know and we could talk about a lot. Continued analysis of how the global economy functions, creating winners and losers with persistent economic inequalities. That analysis is being carried out in many circles, including by Miguel and many others within the ecumenical community and among secular academic scholars. But the question I want to ask is this. What is the changing economic landscape within world Christianity, within the resources that belong to those who are part of the world Christian family? While the massive Christian growth in the Christian family has come in the global south, financial resources and material power remain concentrated in the north and the west. With this comes the quiet, continuing assumption that northern centers of power in the church are still in control and able to shape the destiny of world Christianity. Increasingly, that assumption, while true in some material ways, is becoming more and more a spiritual and even practical illusion. Here's the clearest way to understand the division of economic resources within world Christianity. And that means there are people who have tried to put this together, studied it carefully, looking at where world Christianity finds itself, looking at the countries that are there, looking at Christians within those countries, calculating their own median income, calculating their economic resources, and they come up with this conclusion. At least 60% of all Christians are now in the global south in numbers that continue to increase, yet they control only 17% of income from economic resources. 60% in the global south control 17% of economic resources. The other 43% of Christians in the north and the west control 83% of the estimated income, again, within the purview of world Christianity. So, of course, that affects the amount of available resources that can be allocated to theological education, training, healthcare, and missional outreach. A survey of theological educators around the world, conducted by the World Council of Churches, underscored these exact realities. In essence, the global north has too many institutions of theological education which struggle to obtain sufficient students, and the Global South has too few. One can make the argument that the single most important investment to strengthen the future mission of the Global Church would be to increase the capacity for programs of theological education, ministerial formation, and leadership training at all levels of the Church in the Global South. The same imbalance is reflected in the geographical placement of organizational headquarters of world Christianity's global institutions and ecumenical bodies. Cliff will know this has been a theme of mine for some time. The World Council of Churches, the Lutheran World Federation, and other ecumenical bodies cling to their comfortable location in Geneva, Switzerland. I lived there for 6 years on its staff. I love Geneva. But Geneva is the fifth most expensive city for expatriates in the entire world. The World Communion of Reformed Churches recently moved out of Geneva, but instead of relocating to the Global South, where most of its members are, it moved to Hanover, Germany. The Baptist World Alliance is located outside of Washington, D.C. The World Methodist Council, incredibly, has its center in Lake Junaluska, North Carolina. Go figure. The Anglican Communion, of course, is centered in London. World Vision International has its headquarters in California. The World Evangelical Alliance has its main office in New York. The list can go on. Friends, our theology is influenced by what we see when we wake up in the morning. Context makes a difference. Continuing to place the centers of major global institutions and ecumenical bodies in the global north, regardless of various advantages, underscores in symbolic but powerful ways the imbalance of economic resources and institutional power in world Christianity. Now, let me wake you up a little bit. Regarding the imbalance of the capacity for theological education and ministerial training, would it be possible or effective to propose a simple tithe on all the income received by seminaries and theological institutions in the global north? Most of these have very professional and well-developed fundraising operations. What if a way were found to direct just 10% of these funds to strengthen the capacity for theological education and training in the global south? Now, I don't want to give President Jenkins and his advancement staff heart palpitations, but I think it's about time that we have an honest dialogue about the economic inequalities within global Christian communities, especially around ministerial formation. And I wonder, Michael, if your advancement people wouldn't even see a way that they could raise more money if, in fact, a tenth was tithed to the Global South. Finally, regarding the geographical location of major organizations and ecumenical bodies, we know that for some, like the WCC and the World Communion of Reformed Churches, this matter has been considered and now is settled, at least for the foreseeable future. For others, this issue may still be open. But for all of us, here's the challenge we face. We must search courageously for meaningful ways that shift not only economic resources, but institutional power, organizational culture, and theological capital to those locations in the global south and east that are now destined to shape the future directions of world Christianity. Fourth is the migratory landscape. The landscape of migration in the life of world Christianity has been changing in ways that we have not noticed. And this has deep implications for our discernment to renew the vision and practice of ministry, of mission, and evangelism. Today, an estimated 214 million people are migrants, meaning they have moved or are moving from one country to another for a number of compelling reasons. This means that people on the move who have made this relocation or in the process are equivalent in number to the fifth largest country in the world. Now, of these people, 105 million, or nearly half, are Christian. So while Christianity accounts for almost a third of the world's population, Christians are overrepresented among migrants, accounting for nearly half of those who have moved from one country to another. Just this group, the Christian portion, is equivalent to the 12th largest country in the world, greater than the population of Germany or of Ethiopia or Egypt or France or numerous other countries. The chief destination of immigrants are North America, Europe, Australia, and the Arab states in the Gulf region, the Persian Gulf. Yet immigrants cross boundaries between countless countries. Take Ghana, for instance. In the year 2012, 810,000 had immigrated from Ghana, while 1.8 million had immigrated to Ghana. Of those who immigrated out of Ghana, two-thirds were Christians. And in total, 120,000 immigrated to the United States and 800,000 to the United Kingdom. Another 190,000 immigrated to Nigeria. The Philippines had 4.63 million people who emigrated. Of those, 76% were Christian. 1.8 immigrated to the United States. People don't realize that after Mexico, the Philippines is the second largest country providing immigrants to the United States. But another 530,000 immigrated to Saudi Arabia. 270,000 to Malaysia. If you want to pursue this, go to Faith on the Move from Pew Research. It will give you any country, and it will list the flows in and out of those who migrate according to religion. There's no other resource that does this, and it is amazing to see what's happening. Immigrants are moving largely from nations of the global south, often from countries where Christian faith is strong and growing, and Christian migrants take their churches with them. I've told the story earlier about the Redeemed Christian Church of God, founded in Nigeria in 1952. It's one of the African instituted churches. It started as a single congregation. It now has 5 million members in 147 countries, including 720 congregations in the United States. Its headquarters is in Floyd, Texas, for the U.S., and they recently built a pavilion there for worship at the cost of $15.5 million, which holds 10,000 people. All of this was built with their own resources, not a dime of outside effort. Its director, Pastor James Fidali, says, "We want to plant churches like Starbucks." I told the group earlier, you should know, they have one of their congregations here in Louisville. It's called the Agape House. It's at 232 Carey Street. And its mission statement says, we want at least one member of every household in Louisville to make it to heaven with us, and we want to plant a parish in every city and town in Kentucky. In Europe, we find similar developments. On any given Sunday in London, an estimated 58% of those attending church services are non-white. Similar situations are found in other major cities. Hamburg, Germany, for instance, has 60 African congregations and an African Christian Council in Hamburg. 30% of the members of Spain's Federation of Evangelical Religious Entities are from groups of immigrants originating in Asia and Africa. Beyond this pattern, Christian migrants also move within and between the continents of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And it's urgent that we assess the missional significance of the global movement of migrant Christians. Jehu Hensels, a native of Sierra Leone who has written Beyond Christendom, Globalization, African Migration, and the Transformation of the West. If you want to read a really thick book on this, read this. Hensels is terrific. He has one line that I will never forget. Every Christian migrant is a potential missionary. In the church's work with migrants and refugees, we've moved helpfully from seeing migrants as objects of our compassion to becoming subjects of their destiny. Such empowerment and advocacy is a continuing urgent need as the number of refugees tragically grows in many parts of the world, including in the U.S. and right here in Louisville. I don't know if you realize it, but Louisville is 14th amongst all the cities in the U.S. receiving refugees, which is remarkable given the size of Louisville. Many of those come through the work of Catholic Charities and the Kentucky Refugee Ministries. But as church bodies relate to the more than 100 million Christian migrants in the world, we must come to understand that many of them, in fact, are the agents of God's mission. It's worth remembering that in the book of Acts, after the Spirit was poured out at Pentecost, many of those preaching the good news were persecuted and fled Jerusalem. And their faith was carried across cultural, ethnic, and racial boundaries. Philip was sent to Samaria, normally hostile country that we heard about from Marian this morning, and then was sent towards Gaza, encountering and baptizing the Ethiopian eunuch. There's a message here. Then, when these early followers ended up as migrants in Antioch, the church that emerged there was led by a multicultural group that included Niger, a black African, and Manian, a former member of Herod's court who had been converted. This church in Antioch is the church that became the center of God's mission in the world. God's mission in the world historically did not flow from Jerusalem. It flowed from Antioch. So the connection between migration and mission runs deep, functioning in a variety of ways, usually unplanned and unanticipated at the time in the history of the church. In the changing landscape of world Christianity today, we must once again make the connection between patterns of global migration and God's mission in the world. The modern missionary movement has put most of its effort into raising resources and providing support for those who are to be sent across boundaries in order to share, as I said at the opening, in word and deed, the transforming love of God known in Jesus Christ. Traditionally, that's what most modern mission agencies have tried to do, and we have had people here who have spent their life making that happen. And even as world Christianity makes this decisive shift to the global south, many in the church still work with this paradigm of carrying out programs of mission. But what if, in fact, migration is a primary means through which God's Spirit is moving, unfolding the ongoing work of the Missio Deo, or God's mission in the world? Can we imagine how that could be the case? Can we see this as at least part of the emerging landscape of world Christianity? And if so, how would that challenge and change the practices that have characterized our attempts to participate in God's mission? These global realities also come home, touching the ministry of each of our congregations. As I said at lunch, 43 million people in the U.S. were born in another country, according to the 2010 census. Of those, 74% are Christian, 5% are Muslim, 4% are Buddhist, 3% are Hindu. Immigration into the U.S. has had its greatest impact on the Christian community. These changing realities, resources, and gifts of world Christianity are being brought to our doorstep. The question is whether we can receive this and see it as a mark of God's mission reaching out to us. Again, the words of Jehu Hensel maybe provide the best perspective of how migration should impact our future understanding of mission. He says, first, that attentiveness to the nature and composition of human migration is crucial for understanding the possibilities and potential of Christian missionary endeavor. Second, that in much the same way that the Western missionary movement proved to be decisive for the current shape of global Christianity, okay? So the historic Western missionary movement in many ways shaped where world Christianity is today. The future of global Christianity is now inextricably bound up with the emerging non-Western missionary. Just a fancy way of saying what I've already tried to explain. Next, the ecumenical landscape. We conclude these reflections, these six ways for thinking about the changing landscape of global Christianity, by focusing on the ecumenical landscape of world Christianity. How is that changing? What does that suggest for mission and ministry? While much could be said, I want to focus on just two realities. First, the ecumenical landscape is becoming increasingly fractured into endless denominations. Now, personally, I'm grateful for the heritage of the Reformed tradition, which courageously demonstrated at its beginning that an understanding of God's truth and intentions for the church could require, in extreme circumstances, breaking away from established dogma and institutional authority. But in the nearly 500 years that have followed, we're coming up on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, it's worth reflecting on where this precedent has brought us. I was telling Cliff and Catherine, I want to write either an article or a short book called What the Reformation Needs to Repent From. And here's one of the things. The idea that any group with a slightly different understanding of Christian truth can separate itself from others in the body of Christ and establish its own denominational structure has become so commonplace and so prolific that we barely give it a second theological or biblical thought. And as we look at global Christianity's landscape, we can't help but notice how what we confess as one holy Catholic and apostolic church has in fact become endlessly and ceaselessly divided. Those of us who are Protestant call these divisions denominations. It's a kind word for what they actually are. Gordon Conwell's Center for Global Christianity, located near Boston, keeps the best track of all this. There are people who actually try to count the number of denominations. Here's our present shameful and sinful state of affairs. Today, there are an estimated 43,800 denominations in the world. This staggering proliferation of divided institutional churches never could have been imagined in the first 1,500 years of Christian history. And our only proper response should be one of repentance. We are faced, therefore, with the growing complexity, enormous diversity, and proliferating disunity of world Christianity, and this trend is still heading in the wrong direction. In terms of separate denominations, we are becoming more rather than less divided. And all this is happening despite the enormous progress made by the modern ecumenical movement. A second feature of this ecumenical landscape is the relative isolation of world Christianity's major streams or traditions. And let me illustrate. August of 2013, I attended the 23rd World Pentecostal Conference in Kuala Lumpur. We were a small ecumenical delegation that were right in the front of 3,760 Pentecostals, very easily identified as the only ones who weren't always raising their hands. There were participants from 73 countries gathered together for dynamic worship, dynamic preaching, high octane worship, and numerous workshops, which filled the time at the Calvary Church, a Pentecostal megachurch whose pastor, Prince Gunaratnam, serves as the current president of the Pentecostal World Fellowship. But the Pentecostal world lives mostly within its own bubble. And those outside of it, both from other Christian communities and the media, remain largely insulated from a deeper knowledge and understanding of its dynamics. Lori Goodstein, who's the religion reporter of the New York Times, is a friend of mine. I asked her if she had heard that all the Pentecostals in the world were gathering in Kuala Lumpur. Of course she hadn't. I mean, this is not even on people's radar. Now, less than 3 months later, I joined with about 3,000 official participants and many more Korean visitors at the WCC's 10th Assembly in Busan. Cliff, of course, was there, and probably some of you. This gathering was more ecumenically expansive, representing the churches that make up the fellowship of the ecumenical movement, as well as many visitors. Yet what struck me was how the gatherings in Kuala Lumpur and in Busan represented two very separate worlds. It's as if these two Christian environments have been hermetically sealed off from one another, almost in a state of ecclesiological apartheid. For instance, I'm sure that there were not even 50 people in the world who attended both the Pentecostal World Conference and the WCC Assembly. Yet for the sake of God's mission in the world, the Pentecostal and ecumenical worlds need one another desperately in the journey of Christian unity and mission. Thus, the ecumenical landscape of world Christianity faces divisions not simply of doctrine and historical traditions. Rather, these divisions within the worldwide body of Christ are continually reinforced on a daily basis through institutional power at local, national, regional, and global levels that keep the vast majority of Christians, congregations, denominations, and organizations functioning within their separate worlds, isolated from the other major streams of world Christianity. There are, however, some places of hope. One way to bridge these major denominational and institutional divides permeating world Christianity is to establish a safe place which gathers those representing the full breadth of the global Christian community. Within the U.S., that's what we saw in the emergence of Christian churches together in the U.S. For the first time, official representatives of mainline denominations, Orthodox churches, some historic black churches, evangelical and Pentecostal churches, and the Roman Catholic Church have gathered together in a place of fellowship and witness. Cliff was present with me when that initiative was begun over a decade ago. On a worldwide level, this same vision has been the calling and the purpose of the Global Christian Forum. Begun as an initiative emerging out of the World Council Assembly in Harare in 1998, and then becoming autonomous, the Global Christian Forum has become a place of a fresh and credible movement that offers a way forward that transcends these divisions. Catherine Johnson and I are privileged to serve on the steering committee of this initiative. The Pentecostal World Fellowship, the World Council of Churches, the World Evangelical Alliance, and the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity in the Vatican are the four key organizations all officially supporting the Global Christian Forum. And now nearly all Christian world communions, the Lutheran World Federation, the Mennonite World Conference, the World Communion of Reformed Churches, the Organization of African Instituted Churches, and more, support this initiative in tangible ways. Two global gatherings have been held in Lemero, Kenya in 2007, in Manado, Indonesia in 2011, along with many regional gatherings and other consultations. And at all of these gatherings, half of the participants are Pentecostals and evangelicals who have not previously taken part in ecumenical events. At its starting point, the Global Christian Forum always invites each participant to simply share the story of his or her personal journey of faith. Sometimes that process alone takes a day or a day and a half. But that always breaks down existing stereotypes and establishes a climate of trust. This forum is a very modest and fragile initiative. It has only one staff person, an annual budget of a little more than $200,000. But in the face of the overwhelming complexity and diversity of world Christianity, it seems like but a mustard seed, yet one hopes it could grow and flourish. And there are other signs of hope as well on the horizon. Most notable is Pope Francis. The words he shares and the actions that he symbolizes are creating a climate for ecumenical relations between Catholic and non-Catholic parts of Christ's body that have not been seen since Vatican II. Despite all the theological discussion and controversy around how we understand the role of the Bishop of Rome, no one can deny the representative and convening potential of this office, especially as it is being exercised by Pope Francis. Thus we may hope and also act in expectation of new avenues that can transcend one of world Christianity's most fundamental divisions. I want to conclude by offering you something that you can take home in the place of ministry where you are. I'm convinced that despite what's happening at the global level, the new ecumenical frontier is actually in our local cities and towns. And that's because immigrants find their new home both within those cities, and also within the suburbs. It's because world Christianity is now coming to our doorstep, and we have the opportunity in our local settings to bridge the gaps that typify those things which divide world Christianity. I'd like to give you some perspective of how this is happening in different cities, including here in Kentucky. Look at Chicago, for instance. It has 590,000 immigrants within its city limits, but 984 foreign-born residents now live in Chicago's suburbs. So where immigrants find themselves is continually changing. In the last decade, we've witnessed the rapid growth of immigrants in several cities in the middle of the country. Charlotte, Raleigh, Nashville, and Indianapolis all have had more than 100,000 foreign residents by the year 2010. In Kentucky, the total immigrant population is around 140 to 150,000. That's smaller compared to other states, but the rate of the growth of Kentucky's immigrant population between 2010 and 2012 was 70%, a faster rate of growth in all but six states in the nation. And we can assume that those same figures from 2012 to now are continuing. Now, recall that about two-thirds of these immigrants are Christian, and thus establishing monoethnic congregations or joining multiracial churches, finding ways to nurture and deepen their own faith within the community of believers across the cities of this state and throughout the nation. And in my view, all this represents the new ecumenical frontier of our time. It's urgent that we pay attention to the growing diversity of world religions in our midst. And I want to say that as strongly as I can. But it's also urgent that we pay attention to the growing diversity within the Christian community and see the new ecumenical opportunities that are before us. If you took that seriously in your place, when you leave here from the Festival of Theology, what might you do? I want to suggest just some simple steps. First, discover who is there. Discover who your neighbors are. The first step is to discover immigrant congregations that are already there, noticed, but unnoticed and neglected. This requires some attentive work. And then, like all ecumenical efforts, the beginning point is building relationships of trust. Any fundraiser will tell you that people give to people, not to an organization that lacks a personal connection. The same is true in ecumenical work. People, including pastors and denominational leaders, join an ecumenical fellowship or council because they have trusted relationships with people who are its key leaders. Relationships continue to define the foundation for any fresh effort to discover and make visible the leadership of the church. Second, listen to one another's stories of faith. Do what we've done in the Global Christian Forum. When you gather Orthodox priests, evangelical personalities, Korean pastors, Hispanic Pentecostals, African Independent Church leaders, Catholic bishops, Methodist ministers, African American pastors, Lutheran bishops, Indonesian Presbyterians, Nigerian Baptists, Coptic Orthodox Christians, and Kenyan Anglicans, which is a summary of who is around in our midst. This requires listening to one another's stories of their Christian pilgrimage. Third, begin to enter into theological dialogue. Begin to talk about those things that you each see either the same or differently. Fourth, and maybe more important, work for justice in your city or community. What will also unite you is when you say, let's put first the welfare of the city. Think of the images from the Hebrew people in exile in Babylon who want to seek the good of the city where they find themselves. Powerful, powerful words for immigrant communities. Fifth, explore what common mission or evangelism means together in your local setting. And sixth, worship and pray together. Learn how to gather in worship and prayer. Those six suggestive steps, which will take time, are things that can help emerge in any local community as you discover the diversity of Christians that are there. We're in the post-resurrection season of the church year. And that's why I think our invitation is simply to walk together with old and new partners on a common pilgrimage. We remember those two disciples walking together to Emmaus as we share with each other all that is happening in our common attempts to follow Jesus. And when you have accompanied one another faithfully and honestly, and then come to a table to eat together, in unexpected grace-filled moments, you will suddenly know the very real presence of Christ in your communion with one another. And then you will race to tell others. Thank you.